Okay, welcome back to our series on Jews, Judaism, and Modernity, our Jewish history series here at webyeshiva.org. I am Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, and you are our students here at Web Yeshiva. I'm just checking to see who's on with us tonight. Okay, if you have a webcam, hit the send video button. Jerry, Brian. Okay, here we are, still in Russia, 19th century. Various attempts have been made to modernize the Jew, to bring him out of a very narrow set of occupations that are viewed as, at best, unproductive. To Russify the Jew. None of this has worked, neither through education, nor through attempts to reform, nor through this kind of top-down motivated Haskalah that worked with a very different dynamic in the Pale of Settlement than it did in Germany, back in Berlin. And nothing's working. Nothing's working. And at a certain point, we encounter an anti-Semitism that's different than the anti-Semitism that's built into the woof and warp of daily life. And the way modern anti-Semitism in Russia plays out, or in Eastern Europe, is different than the way it plays out in Western Europe, and we'll have to make the trip back west in a couple of weeks to examine how the story unfolds there. But these are all things that really lead up to the end of the great Jewish experiment in Europe, the millennial plus experiment of Jewish settlement in Europe. I say that, of course, cognizant of the fact that online with us are people who are not only currently in Europe, but are part of an unbroken chain of Jewish descent in Europe. But I think that they would probably be the best witnesses to testify that, nevertheless, despite their presence in places that are not really very far away from the places we'll be talking about tonight, something cataclysmic occurred 70 or so years ago, despite their presence there still, it ain't the same Jewish settlement in Europe that it was throughout many centuries. The term anti-Semitism itself, is a neologism. It's a new term coined only in 1879, believe it or not, by someone named Wilhelm Marr, M-A-R-R. He was an famous anti-Semite, an anti-Jewish spokesman in Germany, and he was speaking euphemistically. This is the case in the lexicon of words of hate, that often terms are coined euphemistically or through other means, and they stick. And the term anti-Semitism, of course, in other words, got nothing to do with Semites. You know, it's even though we Jews are Semitic peoples, anthropologically speaking. It's a euphemism for the term, the German term Judenhass, Jew hatred. You know, which was is a much more, you know, bold, blatant, explicit statement of exactly what it is. And of course, anti-Semitism is just one of many. Many terms added to the dictionary that are products of anti-Semitism. Words like pogrom, words like even genocide, ghetto. These are all terms that enter the lexicon because of us, because of the Jewish people and our sometimes difficult relations with our neighbors. Even the term Holocaust is an interesting term. It's a Greek term. It already appears in the Septuagint, the Targum HaShivim, of the Torah into Greek. It is the term in Greek for the Ola, the Korban Ola, which is the sacrifice which is completely burnt up. There are different types of sacrifices, as you know, and the Korban Ola is the Korban, the sacrifice which is completely burned up. So Ola, Holocaust, is probably related. Holo is probably etymologically connected to Ola. But it meaning that which is completely consumed by the flames, and then later, of course, is applied to describe the Shoah, what we call in Hebrew here in Israel, the Shoah, but the Holocaust of European European Jewry. So all of these, this dictionary of terms, which we'd be better off to do without, are all part of the legacy of anti-Semitism, of European anti-Semitism at that. Alexander II, who looks so unhappy, but that might have something to do with how itchy that mustache must have been. Alexander II becomes a Tsar in 1855. He's got a nice reign from 1855 to 1881. He is, despite his dour demeanor here in this photograph, he is, probably the high water mark of Russian emperors. He is liberal. He's responsible for all types of liberal reforms, not all of which were necessarily motivated by a liberal ideology, but by some kind of pragmatic notion. So very early in his reign, in 1856, he ends the Cantonist system, which we spoke about, that terrible, horrible system by which young Jewish boys were taken off to the Russian army, sometimes at the age of 8 or 9, or certainly on the books from the age of 12. And then at the age of 18, they start their regular army service for 25 years, which basically means their life is over. Either they're literally, their physical life ends because they somehow die along the way, but certainly their spiritual life, their connection to the Jewish people, ends. And we discussed how it was a very negative experience for the Jewish community itself. In 1856, he ends the Cantonist system. And again, not motivated by love of the Jews, not necessarily even motivated by some kind of liberal notion, but just simply, it was an ineffective system. It's true that many thousands of young Jewish boys were destroyed, but it didn't do anything to modernize, to liberalize, or to reform the Jewish community itself, which was, after all, what it was designed to do, and it was just simply inefficient. In 1861, he's responsible for emancipating the serfs, which we I think discussed last time. He becomes he's the Abraham Lincoln, as it were, of Russia. And again, these reforms were probably equally motivated by fear of revolution. In Russia, there's always this fear of revolution, and of course, it wasn't a fear for nothing. The Tsar usually had good reason to fear that there was going to be a revolt. And there are different modes by which a Tsar will rule, either with a carrot or with a stick, in order to try to keep everything under control. Under his rule, the Pale of Jewish Settlement is widened, and for certain classes of Jews, the Pale of Jewish Settlement is even abolished. These are all types of half-emancipation or quasi-emancipation for the Jews, and indeed it begins to lead towards a certain amount of greater openness to the Haskalah, to the Enlightenment, to secular learning, especially in the larger cities of Moscow and St. Petersburg, where Jews were allowed to settle. Of course, Jews in the urban centers were always more reform-minded, liberal-minded, as we saw in the experience of Berlin. Ironically, his reforms, which again were motivated by a desire to keep the revolutionary tendencies at bay, ended up, sometimes you let the genie out of the bottle, ended up greasing the wheels for revolutionary activities. In the mid-1860s, there was a Polish uprising with a certain amount of Jewish involvement. In 1866, there was an assassination attempt on his life, one of a number of assassination attempts. We'll see in the end, of course, he is assassinated. We'll get to that. An assassination attempt by a socialist group, and he's forced, basically, or he's convinced to abandon his reform attempts and to become more reactionary. In 1870, he actually revives a decree against traditional dress that had been lifted about Jewish traditional dress, and he revives that decree against it. In the revival of the anti-Jewish policies that come about as a reaction to the attempts on his life, to the revolutionary activities, he used paid informants, generally speaking, Jewish apostates. Perhaps the most famous is a fellow by the name of Jacob Bronfman, who unfortunately I was not able to track down a picture of any place. Bronfman, who died in 1879, he was probably born around 1825, was an apostate Jew. He had himself fled from the choppers. They tried to chop him to be taken away as a Cantonist, and he never forgives the Jewish community for that experience. We don't know too much about his background, but you can imagine a scenario: a young boy, basically, kidnapped, has to flee his kidnappers, is distanced from his home, from his family. This is done by the betrayal, the sense of betrayal that it was done by his own people, by his own community. And he never gets over that. He never forgives the Jewish community that did this, that tried to do this to him. You see exactly the kind of rotting away from the inside that we spoke about when we talked about the Cantonist system. And because of this, he apostatizes. He becomes a Christian, and he teaches a Hebrew, the Hebrew language, at a Greek Orthodox seminary, where he, sets up a base, trying to convince other Jews to leave the fold, to convert to Christianity. In the 1860s, he begins these slanderous attempts to convince both the church and the government about these secret Jewish governments. This is an idea that will keep coming back throughout the history of modern anti-Semitism, this notion of the secret Jewish undergrounds. Later we'll hear about the protocols of the Elders of Zion. These ideas, have their roots in a fear that the Jew is part of this international cabal of revolutionaries, of a fifth column, of trying to undermine what's going on. And his particular angle is focused on the Kahal, on the Jewish autonomous or semi-autonomous community. And he writes this book called The Book of the Kahal, which is a slanderous description of Jewish life and the Jewish community and how Jewish community is organized and how ultimately the Jewish community is against the authority of the Russian government. The book is published first in 1869, and then it's published again in an expanded edition in 1875. It's translated into other languages, into French and Russian and French and German and Polish, and has a very wide distribution. He makes points about the revolutionary nature of the Jewish community, that the Jewish community, the Kahal, was trying to incite Jews to be disloyal to the state. He makes suggestions, programmatic suggestions, about closing communal structures like religious education, charitable organizations, charitable, the Gamachim, charitable Chevrot, etc., 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 because of their disloyalty, because of their revolutionary agenda, their so-called revolutionary agenda. The book is a collection of these misquotes and twisted quotes from the Gemara, from the Talmud, which always, in these types of attempts, going back to the Middle Ages, becomes the focus of anti-Jewish propaganda. Because the Gemara is so vast and so large, you can cherry-pick quotes out of context, and perhaps even sometimes in context, to make an argument that the halakha, that the Talmud, that the Jewish law, that the Jewish tradition is anti-Christian. This is reminiscent of another famous case. Does this remind you of some other scenario, some other case from Jewish history? Does it know? Doesn't ring a bell? So the Ramban, in the 13th century, the Ramban, you may recall, the Ramban Nachmanides was forced to engage in a public debate to defend Judaism from some claims that were very similar to those that were being made in the 19th century in Russia, two very different societies, very different places, very different points in history, but some very similar things. The Ramban, called before the king, has to defend Judaism, and particularly the Talmud, against his interlocutor, somebody by the name of Pablo Christiani, who also was an apostate Jew, familiar with the writings of the Gemara and the Talmud, who's able to twist it around against the Jewish interest, and the Ramban has to engage him in a debate. The Ramban, unfortunately, had the bad fortune of winning that debate, which was not really an option. And because of that, he understands he's not exactly exiled, but he does leave Spain and, of course, realizes his dream of Aliyah at a quite old age, and comes and settles at the end of his life here in Eretz Yisrael. And in a very similar way, this kind of debate with an apostate, we have actually The Ramban wrote a transcript of the debates between him and Pablo Cristiani. We have them in his writings in the Kitvei Ramban. It's also available in English as the I think it's called the Disputation of the Ramban in his writings in English by Rabbi Chevel. Rabbi Chevel published the Kitvei Ramban. Oops, wrong, writing in the wrong language here in the chat. And these are available. They're really quite interesting to read, these transcripts of the disputation. Unfortunately, this book, the Book of the Kahal of Brafman's, is sent around to Russian officials throughout the empire as a almost as a guidebook on how to expose Jewish disloyalty. In 1871, a special committee on Jewish affairs was established at the Ministry of the Interior in order to monitor the goings-on of the Kahal, of the Jewish community, and to investigate the claims that are made by this book. The book itself, throughout the end of the 19th century, serves as the prime basis of all of the prime basis of knowledge, of Christian knowledge of Jews, of what Jews are, what they believe, what they do, etc. In 1871, there's a pogrom in Odessa. Here's Odessa. It's always good to take a look at the map. I had sent to you a collection of lots of different maps, which are always good to keep handy. But Odessa is here on the shores of the Black Sea in the south of the Ukraine, what today is the Ukraine. This is these maps are these are contemporary political borders. But in what today is the Ukraine, here in the on the border of the Red Sea, Odessa is a large Jewish community. It's a large city. A lot of us probably come from there. My father's family, my father's family, rather, came from someplace in that general neck of the woods. There's 3 days of violence and rioting against the Jews, without any kind of interference on the part of the authorities. In 1879, there's a blood libel. By the 1880s, throughout Russia, there's just this sense that whatever optimism there was for reform in the 1860s, 20 years earlier, it's completely dashed. In March of 1881, Alexander II is assassinated. Here you go. Here you go. He's assassinated in St. Petersburg. One of the five assassins is actually a Jewish woman named Helfman. We don't know all too much about her. His son, Alexander III, there he is. There's Alexander III, who's, I mean, he's not a boy anymore at the time of the assassination. He's already in his 30s. He's about 30, 35, 36 years old. But he's there by his father's side at the moment of the assassination. It was a pretty messy affair. A bomb goes off underneath his carriage. His legs are blown off. His face is blown off. He doesn't die immediately. He suffers for a short period of time. Not a pretty scene. His son, Alexander III, takes over, and you can imagine, is not inclined to be very liberal, and he becomes actually quite reactionary. He's a throwback to his Eltazeti, to Nicholas I, and becomes very repressive and very reactionary. There were a number of consequences of the assassination, some of them actually ironic. For our purposes, the main consequence, of course, is a wave of anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic pogroms and anti-Semitic laws, legislation designed to make Jewish life difficult. But in addition, the suppression of civil liberties in Russia, the rise of the role and use of secret police in Russia, the empire had its secret police, which is of course in some ways a tradition which will continue to the Soviet era and the KGB, although of course a revolution in between comes along to change those players, but some of the techniques remain the same. Often the revolutionaries that will come and overthrow an empire or overthrow a ruler will yet adopt some of the means that the overthrown had used to stay in power if they had been found to be generally effective. Alexander III and all future czars after him were very mindful of the fate of Alexander II and didn't want to meet that same fate. And the oppression of any type of protest movement, the cracking down on any type of suspected rebellious activity, general suppression of personal freedoms throughout Russia, these were all things which would last, up until our own memory. I'm just doing a quick check to see that, we're all above a certain age. I'm guessing that we are. We all remember this. I mean, I remember, a couple of years ago, Natan Sharansky came and spoke at a conference that we had. This was in his days as a politician when he was still in the Knesset. He spoke at a conference that we had that Atid organized. The Atid is the parent body of Web Yeshiva, and so I was able to. I was honored to introduce him. I don't recall what his position at the day. He was a sar. He was a minister in the government, and I couldn't help myself. Here's Natan Sharansky. I mean, Natan Sharansky was the when I was a kid in high school, we wore the bracelet with his name that we should remember that he was at the time in prison. And it was like meeting a true Jewish hero. He found all of this very amusing and maybe even a little juvenile that I should introduce him with those kinds of memories of what that was. But that experience that there were in our own memory, that there were was that kind of oppression, that there was those techniques, has its origin in this period. Finally, maybe the biggest irony is that Alexander II had drawn up plans which had not yet been made public. Apparently he was like on his way to go announce this, that he was going to create the Duma. The Duma is today the lower house of the Russian parliament. Basically he was going to for the first time in Russian history allow an elected representation of the people, an elected parliament. Had that happened, it's possible, this is pure speculation, you know, the kind of historical parlor game that we play of, like, what would have happened if. But had that happened, had he not been assassinated, had he been allowed to initiate these types of liberal democratic reforms, who knows what would have happened? History in Russia might have taken a completely different turn. Now, of course, other events would have had to happen, but you can imagine a scenario in which democracy is, and liberalism and democratic institutions and notions are able to take root in the 1880s, that's going to change what's going to happen in 1917. That's going to change what's going to happen with future revolutions. And you don't need to be, completely delusionary to imagine that the entire history of a continent might have unfolded differently, not just in terms of the revolution that would ultimately end the control of the Tsars over Russia, but the rise of the Soviet Union and the Cold War and so many other things. It's scary to imagine that. So the day after he comes up with this plan that that's what they're going to do, he's assassinated by people that want reform. But he himself was on the path towards introducing greater liberal reform. So it's a tragic but ironic feature of his assassination. Alexander III is controlled, as often happens, in a Rasputin-type way by... So, Sherry, that's a good question. We're going to come to that. How all of this affects Jewish emigration? Yes, there is a large emigration of Jews from Russia to the United States. But we're going to come to that. He's controlled by this figure, Konstantin. I'm going to try to get this right. Pobedonostov. I'm sure I didn't get that right. Pobedonostov was a statesman, a church official. He was a great anti-Jewish propagandist. He was largely responsible for fixing this notion in the minds of the public that the Jews were responsible for the assassination of Alexander II. He has this terrible fear of the reactionaries, of the revolutionaries, and he thought that if we could scapegoat the Jews, that would divert some attention away from where he wanted the attention diverted. And in fact, the assassination is in March. On April 15th, the day after Easter, or the day after Eastern Orthodox Easter, or Greek Orthodox Easter, Russian Orthodox Easter, rather, a series of pogroms begins. It's interesting to note, we'll see, the day before Christmas and the day after Easter are always dates that are particularly dangerous for the Jews, and they're always dates which are, they're often dates which are Mu'ad L'Puranut, which attract the attention of pogroms. It's interesting, of course, that Christmas, it's always the night before Christmas and the day after Easter. Now, that might have something to do with the fact that Easter always, Christmas, of course, falls out. It's a movable feast. It's always on a fixed date, which can fall out on any day of the week. But Easter always comes out on a Sunday. So the day before Easter is not a good day for pogroms, because it's a day when Jews are not usually out and about. They're in home or they're in shul. And you need to have some kind of flashpoint which is going to get the pogrom going. So for Easter, it always happens the day after. For Christmas, it always happens the day before, or orphans' case. This series of pogroms, which run from April of 1881 to May of 1882, are called the Sufot Banegev. It's a nickname that they take on from this pasuk in Yeshayahu about the it's a vision that Yeshayahu in Perek Kafalef of Yeshayahu has about a very angry nevuah, which is compared to storms that come up out of the desert or the Negev, the south. Of course, they take place in terms of the Russian Empire. They're in the south of the Russian Empire. So they take on this nickname, the Sufot Banegev, the storms in the south. Apparently, the event that predicated it was in a Jewish inn, or a drunken Russian soldier was thrown out of a Jewish inn, and this leads to rioting and attacks, and it spreads throughout all of White Russia. Between April and December, 215 communities experienced pogroms. Many hundreds of thousands of Jews lose property or homes or livelihood. That's interesting. Sherry mentions that her grandmother lived through various pogroms. At this period, in 1881... or later, at the beginning of the 20th century. I don't know how old your grandmother is. Correct. My great-grandparents left that area in the 1880s and came to America as children. My great-grandparents got to America as children in the 1880s, and... you know, we assume because of the events of this period. The question of how the pogroms spread so fast and so quickly is an interesting one. On one hand, the advent of the telegraph greased those wires. The greased lightning along the wires of the telegraph was something that was able to spread news in a way that was not possible beforehand, and that led to the fast and rapid spreading of the pogroms. And also because there was government support, there was encouragement for these things to happen. The government not only did they stand idly by, but there was encouragement for these types of things. The Russian intelligentsia, Tolstoy, Chekhov, the kind of Russian intelligentsia that in all societies people of the spirit are able to influence, they also took a pass, and they at best didn't denounce what was going on. And the Jews are just terribly disillusioned. The maskilim, the practitioners of the Enlightenment, that thought that they were on the road to emancipation, were terribly disillusioned. The only group in Russia to defend the Jews were, of course, the socialists. But that was only insofar as the friend of my enemy is my enemy. Insofar as the Jews were being targeted by the government and the socialists were anti-government, so suddenly you have an ally in the Jew, but not out of any kind of love for the Jews or out of any sense of the criminality of what was going on. Because of that, of course, Jews themselves are, to a certain degree, attracted to socialism. The Bund is a Jewish socialist group founded in 1897. Those socialist notions of the Russian Jewry will later be transplanted to Palestine, to Eretz Yisrael, and when the Jews, the masses, the waves of Aliyah will bring some of those notions here, and they're still deeply rooted socialist notions and institutions and orientations that are still present today in Israeli society. The whole notion of the kibbutz 100 years ago comes from these notions, transplanted notions of socialism, which come to Israel through Russia. In 1882, the government passes what are called or nicknamed the May Laws, because they're passed in May of 1882. And the May Laws, which are repressive for Jews, let me just take a look at the clock. Oh, it's getting late. They prohibit, you can read through them quickly yourselves on the screen. They prohibit Jews from owning or managing any type of real estate, which was, of course, a major Jewish profession, to be to own the leases on property, to be innkeepers and things like that. No business on Sunday. Jews are not allowed to transact business on Sunday, which is, of course, very difficult because they don't transact business on Saturday either. The idea of a 2-day work week is a 20th century invention. And that also cuts down their ability to compete with other with their non-Jewish with their non-Jewish counterparts, etc. The innovation of this type of anti-Semitism is a in the medieval era, if there were pogroms or if there were riots against Jews, which there were all the time, the government would generally fulfill its responsibility to maintain some kind of public order. The innovation here in this modern Russian anti-Semitism is that the government itself is supporting the chaos. In the Middle Ages, if the government wanted to be anti-Semitic, it would kick out the Jews. It would expel them. And we had this all the time, most famously in Spain in 1492. That, may have been wrong. It may have been unethical. It may have been whatever term you want to use. But it wasn't illegal. Technically speaking, it wasn't illegal. The king, whoever lives in the in my kingdom, says the king, is here by my permission. If I revoke my permission for your right of residency, you have to get out. It's not nice. It doesn't make you a nice guy, but it's within the context of that society, it's legal. The methods of the Tsarist regime, later, of course, to be refined by the Nazis, was that the government itself institutes the public disorder. We have this letter from 1882, from February 1882. It was a letter to an editor written by a Jew in Vilna, and it's just a terrible portrait of despair. He writes, "We expected a pogrom during the Christmas holidays, and the city was in a state of siege. Before the holidays, we went to the governor and asked for protection. The Cossacks were called and the stores closed for 3 days. And now, although the holidays have passed quietly, there were no riots, our fears have not been allayed, and we expect a pogrom at any minute, we see no end to our anxiety. For ahead of us are the civil new year, the week of butter." I'm not sure what that is. Joel, do you know what that is, what that's referring to? No? Okay, I'm not sure what that's referring to. I assume it's some kind of Russian tradition or holiday or civil holiday. The holiday of baptism and Easter. How many threats and curses we heard before the holidays? If someone gets into an argument with a Christian, the latter immediately says, "Just wait, soon we'll settle all the scores." Oh, Natalia is on. She says it's some kind of carnival, the week of butter. Natalia, remind me, you're originally from Moscow and now you live in Switzerland? Was that correct? Oh, Joel just posted to the chat a description of what this butter week is. Maslenitsa. It's an ancient pagan celebration still included in the calendar festivals in the Orthodox Church. In the pre-church age, at this time of year when the days were getting longer, tribes all over Europe celebrated the revival of nature with pagan rituals, seeing off the winter and greeting spring. Today, the festival is always on the last week before Lent this year, March 7th to 13th. Okay, thank you. So if someone gets into an argument with a Christian, the Christian immediately says, "Just wait, soon we'll settle all the scores," or something similar or worse. What kind of life is this? If I had the courage, now this is just shocking. If I had the courage, I would kill all those close to me, and then I'd kill myself, and the farce would be over. This is just horrific. Of course, it reminds us of accounts during the Crusades. Going back to the Crusades, of Jews martyring themselves and their families to prevent them from being all types of terrible things happening to them, particularly their daughters, if you understand my intention. But this idea that their existence is a farce because the anxiety, the being kind of held mentally, emotionally, socially hostage, awaiting the pogrom is worse than the pogrom itself. If I do not, some drunken riffraff will come along, ravish my wife and daughter, and throw my infant Sonia from the third floor window. Would it not be better for me to kill everyone? What a miserable creature is the Jew. Even when the advantage is clear to him, he cannot summon the courage to do a good thing. Death awaits us in any case, so why should we wait? This is just a terribly bleak, bleak state of mind, a terribly desperate point of view. And it's a function of the fact that the government itself is not governing, but is giving free rein for this to happen. So suddenly, here we are, nearing the end of the 19th century, the world's largest concentration of Jews, upwards of 5 million Jews, are stuck in this situation. What can they do? Well, they can leave, which is difficult. Because a lot of them are in abject poverty, and no matter how bad things are, you need some money to get to where you want to go. And also that sense of, that the Jews are going to like pack out. It's this vicious catch-22. It leads to this fear of seeming disloyal. But even if they can leave, where should they go? Well, they can either go to New York or they can come to Eretz Yisrael. Israel is largely impractical until Herzl, 10 years later, in the 1890s, will start making that a reality. So the main option is to go to the United States. Between 1881 and 1890, 200,000 Jews leave Russia. 135,000 of them go to the United States. Rabbinic leadership is very torn about this. Again, we've a few times made reference with all of the caveats in place to Fiddler on the Roof, because it's a common cultural touchstone, even though it's obviously a work of fiction. I mean, the Shalom Aleichem stories on which they're based are works of fiction. Valachas Kama V'Kama, the Broadway musical, or the film. But this notion of going off to America is very... there's a lot of ambivalence, because it is the secular land, and a fear of what that will lead to. Moshe Leib Lilienblum, who was an important leader of the Russian Haskalah, in the light of the pogroms of the 1880s, says something along the lines of, before the pogroms, our greatest aspiration was to study in the university, was to get a university degree. We thought that would solve all of our problems. Now we realize that that won't solve anything. And he becomes an ardent Zionist. And Zionism, the rise of Zionism as a antidote, as the only true answer to the Jewish question, begins to really stew. And although Herzl, a Western Jew in Vienna, trying to attempt change in Berlin, etc., ultimately it will be the masses of Jews of Russia that will answer that call. I mean, Jews from all over answer the call, but the massive response comes here, and those seeds are planted in 1881 with the rise of these kinds of massive pogroms. There were, of course, other pogroms that lasted often on in different periods. Next time we'll take a little closer look at some of them and how that worked. So I'll sign off now. If anybody has any questions, I'll stay online, and of course you can email me during the week, and we will continue next week, same time, same channel.